From the studios of KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Investigative reporter Robert Kolker is my guest. His book, Lost Girls, An Unsolved American Mystery, was a New York Times bestseller and has earned praise for the way the author masterfully avoids the exploitive tendencies of the true crime genre. The book is the story of how the disappearance of a woman working as a prostitute led to the discovery of a series of serial murders of prostitutes in Long Island. Robert Kolker, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I read an article in a recent issue of Rolling Stone about this Duke University student, maybe you saw it, who's paying her tuition by performing in pornographic videos. And the community of the university learned of this and they shunned her. It's like this horrible thing for her. And it made me think of the biographies that make up a good deal of lost girls. Our society, we create these employment opportunities for women, I guess, and all through history we have, and then is horrified when real people are involved in them. And, you know, it's kind of an old story. It reminded me of the horror films where there's always a girl who does something immoral, like kissing a boy in the parked car or something, that leads to her death at the hands of the blob or whatever it is.
Hate. I think that's a great way of putting it. And those are associations which I so rarely hear, but really apply in this case. You know, the serial killers themselves, when they're interviewed, have said that they try to select victims like prostitutes because they think no one will care about what happened to them, that they'll have no families. And I think if there's something new that Lost Girls has to offer, it's a look at the face of prostitution today, which is slightly different from what it was several years ago. The internet has lowered the barrier or changed the barrier to entry to the job so that the women who are involved look somewhat more like, you know, everyday people in America. They no longer are somehow faceless or have no identity. You know, now the fact that they had no identity is indeed a terrible tragedy, but, you know, the surprise of Lost Girls is that these women are people you might recognize.
Right, they're not standing on a street corner with gigantic high heel shoes and tight red dress and smoking a cigarette or whatever.
Exactly. Now, you know, it's a narrative book, a narrative nonfiction book, and in its way, it's a true crime book. But it also, you know, is talking about a social trend. You know, there was a time a few years ago where people thought that the internet was going to change sex work forever, that it was going to professionalize it, that you wouldn't need a pimp anymore or an escort service, and so you could be a solo practitioner just working on the internet and vetting your clients. But for these women, at least, they were considered every bit as vulnerable by the killer, and they were not, their disappearances were not taken seriously by the police, and, you know, their families were basically helpless when they went missing.
And they weren't taken seriously because they were prostitutes.
Exactly.
Which is baffling, because if a woman disappears, she's disappeared, right?
Right. It's about class, and it's about not just how the police view prostitution, but about how our entire society views prostitution. It's very much along the lines of what you said at the beginning of the segment. You have a society where that creates the opportunities for these women, but then we don't really want to know much about them, and we blame them when things go wrong. Lost Girls has interviews with the police who investigated these crimes. It's still an unsolved case, and yet the chief of detectives at the time, who I talked to, started blaming the victims in the middle of the interview. He said most of these women are killed because they were greedy.
What were they doing that was greedy? I mean, they were just doing their job.
That's true. And in fact, it's the job that is so interesting, at least the way it's changed. I didn't know much about how prostitution had changed before I looked into this. I remarked at the time that a view of these women's lives was a view at a certain segment of America where opportunities are drying up, where for some of these women it's either this or working at the Dunkin' Donuts or the Walmart, that, you know, generations earlier their parents or grandparents had union jobs that, you know, offered some sense of a future. But for these women, it was the money and the promise of social mobility that it offered them that drew them into escort work. They were young, they were in their 20s, they weren't necessarily trafficked or, you know, coerced into the life, and they didn't consider it a life choice. They considered it a way to make money a few days a week here and there.
And what role did drugs play in them?
Well, you know, I'm as much of a victim of these stereotypes as anyone else. When I first learned that four women were found, you know, the remains of four women were found on the beach in Long Island and that they were most likely escorts, I thought we would never learn who these women were, and I thought that they were perhaps lost souls even before they went missing, that they must have gotten into it for the drugs. But what I learned as I found out about the five women I write about in Lost Girls is that if there are substance abuse issues, they come later, and that it's the money they become addicted to first. So you start by taking, you know, working part-time, like taking a weekend and going down to make a lot of money, and then you are suddenly making enough in one, more in one night than what your friends are making in 2 or 3 weeks. And that kind of money becomes addictive. And then you work harder and you hide it more from more people, and the lifestyle becomes harder to sustain, and you numb yourself and you self-medicate, or you take drugs to work harder, or you take drugs because your clients insist you take drugs, and then it becomes part and parcel of your life.
We're talking with Robert Kolka, and his book is called Lost Girls, an unsolved American mystery. Has there been any updates since you've published your book?
Well, the book leaves things open-ended, obviously. It talks a lot about the final moments of Shannon Gilbert's life, where she, you know, she's the first person, the one whose disappearance leads to the discovery of the others.
Yes.
It's a very curious set of circumstances in which she runs from a client's house in a small beachfront community in Long Island, and she pounds on doors screaming for help, and she calls 911, something very unusual for a prostitute to do. And she stays on the phone with 911 for 23 minutes, and she tells them that someone is trying to kill her. And yet, by the time the police arrive, she's completely disappeared, and it's not clear to the police that anything has happened at all, because they don't connect the 911 call with her disappearance. They're just responding to a neighbor's 911 call.
Well, why didn't anyone respond to her 911 call? I mean, they couldn't tell on the phone that she was a prostitute.
What they couldn't tell was where she was. She called and the county answered, and they asked where she was, and she didn't know. So she gave one landmark, Jones Beach, which is a big public beach here in New York.
Right.
And that switched her over to the state police, and then the state police kept her on the phone from there but couldn't locate her. It's unclear what kind of technological capability they had to find her with her cell phone. One of the recurring themes in Lost Girls is how police work is very unlike CSI, and things don't happen overnight, and
yeah,
sometimes don't happen at all.
I guess that's a whole other side of it. But yeah, I mean, we now think that police can just do anything and just find anybody, and
that's right.
You know, because that's how they do it on the TV.
Mm-hmm. So you asked it what's new, and I guess what's new is that the police have nothing, or at least are coming forward with nothing. You know, they have become more defensive since Lost Girls came out, and they insist now that Shannon Gilbert isn't even a murder victim, that her death was somehow accidental, that she died of hysteria, which is almost a Victorian notion. And that, you know, it's just blind luck that her death led to the discovery of four women just like her along the same highway in Long Island. And then now people are seizing on any other bits of evidence that might have been overlooked, trying to think of it as the key. They're looking at dolls that were left at the memorial sites of the women, thinking that it might be more than just a little prank or perhaps a tribute left by somebody who was sympathetic to them. They think maybe it was the killer. They look at, everybody's trying to connect the case to another case of missing prostitutes in Atlantic City. The more you look, the more associations you can find, because this is, in some ways, a story as old as Jack the Ripper.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's prostitutes who get targeted, and you know, there are some terrible cases out there in Detroit and Montreal and other places.
Well, Robert Kolker, do you think prostitution should be legalized? Is that one of the things that you find yourself discussing since you've written Lost Girls?
I get asked that a lot, and I tried to keep an open mind while I was writing the book, and I didn't want the book to turn into a policy book or an advocacy book in that way. What I've come away with now that the writing is finished is I'm convinced that legalization would probably just lead to many negative circumstances, that it would it would sort of provide cover to human traffickers who are bringing in underage people in a way that is undesirable. But what I really have become an advocate for is destigmatization. I think that there's a lot of, you know, shaming that goes on and a lot of stigmatization that goes on with prostitutes, not just by the police, but by all of society. So that we treat them as criminals, and maybe they are technically behaving unlawfully, but we treat them as criminals way out of proportion to the way other low-level offenders are treated.
And gambling, for instance.
Yeah, or even low-level pot dealers. Like, if you're, you know, not paying parking tickets, other crimes that where you perhaps aren't hurting anyone physically, but you are violating the law. But if you're a prostitute, forget about it. It's almost like you're subhuman. You aren't worthy of protection. If you're in trouble, your disappearances aren't taken seriously. And, you know, if you're being hassled by a pimp or an escort service, or if you feel like a client is causing you trouble, the last thing you'd ever want to do is call the police. And incidentally, that's what makes Lost Girls, that incipient moment in Lost Girls where Shannon Gilbert calls the 911 and stays on the phone with them for 23 minutes. It's the last thing a prostitute would ever do is call 911 and stay on the phone with them. She must have been terrified of something, and the neighbors aren't saying what.
Sounds like hysteria to me, Robert Coker.
It could be.
That's what the police are like. You must have really gotten into the lives of these women. I mean, it's kind of like, you remember the movie Laura? I keep making movie associations tonight, but you know the movie Laura where the detective falls in love with the dead girl's portrait? Did you find that happening to you? You really got involved in the lives of these deceased girls.
Well, I've been a writer at New York Magazine, a writer of feature stories for about 15 years now, and the specialty I've developed is a certain, you know, sensitive and empathetic style in writing about people who never thought that they would make the news. And sometimes that's happy stories, and other times it's crime stories. But the common denominator is that they aren't, you know, fancy people or famous people or people who are trying to get media attention. They're people who've been thrust into the spotlight. And so, in a way, I was very prepared to be speaking with what I would call vulnerable people who were very, very cagey and very wary of having their family lives shown to the world, but also terrified that their daughters or sisters would be forgotten or that they would be thought of as just sort of tabloid cartoon characters. So I was really pleased to be able to do that sort of work here. Obviously, it tears you up to spend that much time with, you know, so many people who are in so much pain. But I felt like important work at the time.
Well, and what was it like tracing their lives? I mean, how willing were people? I'm imagining that people who hired them as Johns or whatever you call them were probably not so willing to talk. But how willing was the family to talk?
It was different for every family. Some people came aboard right away, and others came aboard at the very end. I was helped in a way by the fact that these women were deep into their 20s by the time they disappeared. So as far as a technical reporting challenge went, it wasn't just about speaking to families. It was about speaking to people in their adult lives who they knew. And in fact, if you look at Lost Girls, each woman's life is divided into two segments. It's roughly divided up. The first segment of each of their lives is up until the point where they sort of cross over and become, you know, more or less full-time professional sex workers. And then the second part is when their lives are sort of spinning out of control. I'm a big fan of not just straight true crime books, but true crime books that sort of lift the veil on a part of America you don't get to see. And so every time I interviewed family members or friends, I wanted to find out about the towns they were from and the lives that all the relatives lived and what opportunities were there. I love books like Random Family by Adrienne Nicole LeBlanc and The Corner by David Simon that sort of help put you in a place that the media might overlook otherwise. And so I had a mind to do that from the very beginning with Lost Girls. I thought if there's a solution to the case and a killer is found, that would be wonderful. But even if he isn't, this is a chance to do five family portraits and five looks at five parts of America that have really changed over time.
Well, of course, nowadays, everybody who can type can review your book and weigh in on Amazon. And so many people, people love the book, and it's been critically acclaimed, and it's a beautifully written book. But people have said it's pointless because we don't know what happened.
Yeah, the idea of the subtitle, which is An Unsolved American Mystery, was decided very early on because we wanted to send that message to people to not go looking for an ending. And you can argue as much as you want that, you know, An Unsolved Mystery is a very exciting thing to read because the case is still alive. It's not canned. It could change at any time. And a lot of people really dug that. But it is true that when I, you know, looked on Amazon or Goodreads, and of course I only do that 17 or 18 times a day, there are a good chunk of people who just aren't going to get past that. That they say, you know, I really needed an ending, and I understand that. But I'm gratified that there are at least a significant number of people who like what the book does have to offer.
Everything doesn't always get wrapped up in a nice little ribbon, people.
Right. And, you know, I mean, you know, it was a gamble from the beginning, this book. It was a story without an ending. And I wanted to build it so that it would be a worthwhile endeavor, even if the killer wasn't found. The other gamble was making sure that I would learn enough about each woman that we would really understand who they were as people and that they would be distinct enough from one another so that the reader could really get to know each of them and see them as different people. And I worked really hard to do that as well.
How did the process go? I mean, did HarperCollins say, okay, Robert Coker, write this book and we're going to publish it? Or did you have to write it and then try to sell it? Or, you know, how did it go?
Well, I was, you know, I'm really privileged to be a writer for New York Magazine, and I wrote a cover story about the Unsolved case, which was really basically a visit with at least one family member of each of the victims, where they all came to New York and they sat around a table and we had a long conversation where some of them were meeting for the first time, even though they'd been in touch on Facebook. And so they all sat and talked about the case, and they talked about this very peculiar position to be in, where they are now the voice for their lost daughter or sister. But they didn't always approve of everything their daughter or sister did, but they also are very upset about the way they're being remembered. And so there's a little bit of trying to lighten some of the darker aspects of you know, people who they had conflict with in real life. And that was a very tragic part of eventually became a very tragic part of the book, but that was the first thing in the magazine story. And so with that story, I then was able to put together a book deal with Harper at HarperCollins. My editors were David Hershey and Barry Harbo, and they were magnificent. They loved and appreciated the idea that this would be a portrait of five families in five parts of America. They knew it would be a crime story that might not have an ending, and they totally were fine with that. And in fact, when I handed in a first draft that inserted myself into the sections where I was trying to learn more about the women's lives, they came back and said, "You don't need to be in there. You found out enough about them. You nailed it. You found out who each of these women were. So you really don't need to be a mediator in that part of the book." And that was especially gratifying.
To take yourself out of the narrative.
Exactly. And you know, it turns out one of the big questions as I was writing and rewriting the book was, when do I show up, or do I show up at all? And I do show up in a very minimal way in the second half of the book, very much where I show up in real life, which is gathering those family members together for that magazine story and then going and having some one-on-one interviews with some, I would call them suspects, but the police don't call them suspects, you know, with people of interest related to the case. But really, I'm only sort of a fleeting presence in there by the end, which was, again, I think a really nice accomplishment because I didn't want this to be about me. I wanted it to be about the women.
Do you, I'm theorizing that the answer is going to be yes to this, but do you have a theory as to who the killer is?
I'm certain that there are neighbors at Oak Beach and Shannon Gilbert's John is among them who know much more than what they've been saying. I'm not so certain whether or not they've told the police what they know. You know, there's one person who's been talked about a lot who's in the book, and readers can make their own decision about him. I'm still on the fence about him. But I am convinced that you know, that the neighbors know more than what they're saying, and that's about as far as I go.
Well, why do you think Shannon, she had a driver who drove her there.
Right.
And then she ran away from him.
Again, a very, you know, a very good question, and one that's been answered by a lot of different conspiracy theories. Some say that he was enlisted by the John to do something that she found objectionable. Others say that perhaps he was, you know, not the as kind to her as he insisted he was, and then started to try to cover his tracks later. Others say that perhaps he had something to do with the disposal of her body. And then there is the, she was hysterical and was just running away from everything and, you know, had a psychotic break theory, which I suppose is possible, but...
Then why would she have called 911 for 20 minutes?
Exactly. It all seems a little far-fetched. He is a, the driver, and I interviewed him, and I think he also spoke with one television program, and he's someone who, depending on how you look at it, he's either just a low-level guy who, gets jobs driving for escort services, or he's a wannabe pimp who is, trying hard to be a big shot, and it's unclear whether he's capable of the things he's suspected of.
We're talking with Robert Kolker, and his book is Lost Girls, an Unsolved American Mystery. And you wrote this book over a year ago now, and now you're talking to me because the book is coming out in paperback. We didn't get together a year ago when the book first came out. So you've been with this story now a long time. Is it difficult? Do you want to sort of let it go and move on to something else, or is it still an ongoing thing for you?
Well, when I look back on working on the book, I think about all the different directions it went while I was working on it. It was hard to characterize while I was writing it, because I would say, yes, it's a true crime book, but it's not as much of a murder mystery. It's really about five women. Or I'd say, yes, it's a sociology book, but it's also about a plot, with a murder that you have to follow. And I felt like I was constantly zigzagging. And there's a little bit of relief, actually, since the book's been published, to know that the book actually is something, and it isn't just not this and not that and a little bit of this and a little bit of that. And it felt good that it was thought of as a sort of a fresh way of looking at these serial killer cases. I mean, we live in this serial killer world. I remember when I was working on the book, I went to the gym, and there was a TV screen on the elliptical, and I watched the end of one-hour procedural with the serial killer killing women, and then I watched the beginning of another one. It was like SVU and Criminal Minds, and I could probably have sat there all day and watched another one-hour drama about people killing women. And since then, there's, of course, been True Detective, and there's always Dexter, and there's Hannibal, and you can just keep on going. And then there's 24-hour true crime channels like the Investigation Discovery Channel. And so I didn't realize this at the time, but I do think perhaps the public, or at least critics, were ready for a book that looked at things differently, that looked at the human cost, that looked at why people are vulnerable in the first place, that looked at something else besides the killer. And, I haven't written a lot about killers in the past, and there's a reason for that. I do think that they are somehow less interesting than, normal everyday people who wind up in extraordinary situations, like the victims and like the family members in Lost Girls.
And you were able to do that. I mean, this is not to insult all the other true crime books, but this is a piece of literature much more than whatever else those things are. But now what are you working on?
Well, I have, my approach is always narrative, so I have to find the right narrative to hang a story on, but there are a lot of family stories inside Lost Girls. A lot of you could call them dysfunctional, or else very difficult relationships between family members, and that still interests me. And I'm looking at divorce cases and custody battles and changes in divorce laws, and I'm looking for a narrative to hang that on.
Should the case be solved in the future? Do you think you'd revisit this? Write an afterword, or maybe even write a second book?
I think an afterword, definitely. I would add an additional chapter. And when I think about it, I think it's quite possible that that afterword might have very little relationship with anything that happened elsewhere in the book. You know, sometimes these cases are solved 10 years later, or 15 years later, where there's a new killing or a new discovery, a new confession by somebody. Somebody rounded up for something else, and so it could wind up being really something out of the blue. I'm very much afraid that it's going to be one of those cases that takes 10 or 15 years for a breakthrough. I'm hoping I'm wrong about that.
Do you check in periodically with the police, or they probably don't like you?
Yeah, the police are sort of on the defensive about the book, and are not really speaking to the media at all. There's been a change in leadership there, and they've decided that the best policy is silence. But I certainly hear from people affiliated with the case all the time. And, you know, of course, the world of web sleuths, of people on the Internet speculating about the case, you know, I get emails all the time. I get at least one email or call a week from somebody who has a suspicion or a lead. Most of the time it's, you know, an ex-boyfriend or an ex-husband who they suspect.
Hmm.
They always have gone to the police, and the police have always ignored them. And I listen and talk to them about it, and sometimes what they're saying is very provocative and makes a lot of sense. And then other times, the more they talk, the more the notion unravels and it becomes about something else. And it's a sign of exactly what the public fixates on here and what we bring to stories like these extreme cases really bring out something in us.
Well, the book, and it's brilliant, is called Lost Girls, An Unsolved American Mystery. The author, Robert Kolker, thank you so much for being with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you. This has been wonderful. Thank you.
Well, that's all the time we have for From the Bookshelf this week. I hope you enjoyed the program and that you'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to the podcast at iTunes, and you can like us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, Robert Kolker, the book Lost Girls, An Unsolved American Mystery. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.